Hey everyone, it's Jeanette
and Kim,
producers here at The Bitchery of History. As we close out season 3, we want to hear from you, our listeners, and give you something in return. So, from now until the end of May, everyone who leaves us a review will be qualified for a giveaway.
What? Amazing. So you might have seen on our Insta or on the website store that we have brand new Bitches Get Stuff Done stickers, which are amazing. So if you send us a screenshot of your review, we'll send you a sticker in return for free.
For free.
What?
You can DM us your screenshot on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, or you can email us directly at umpboh@gmail.com.
And this giveaway only lasts until May 31st, so hurry and tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, be our friend, get a sticker, and remember,
bitches get stuff done.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
And I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm talking to you about Gurumai Chidvilasananda.
Excellent. I will be sharing the story of Agnadis.
Oh, okay.
Get ready.
All right. Well, get ready for quite the roller coaster with Gurumai.
Okay.
Now, Gurumai is not her birth name. It is her adopted name a little bit later on. She was born Malti Shetty near the foot of a mountain in Mangalore, India on June 24th, 1955, and she was the oldest child of a couple who were from Mumbai, who were devotees of this one guru named Muktananda. Now, he was the founder of this yoga path called Siddha Yoga, and her parents actually frequently took her and her siblings to the ashram, which was the place of the practice for the Siddha Yoga. A little bit of background, because it features very heavily into her life.
Okay.
The Siddha Yoga lineage goes back technically thousands of years, beginning with the first guru, Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
This is from The New Yorker, which is an article I'll get to a little bit later called Oh Guru, Guru, Guru. And it says, in Siddha Yoga, the central goal is awakening of the cosmic energy or Shakti, which is said to be coiled at the base of the spine in a form called Kundalini, and which, when activated, manifests itself as bliss. And it is through a guru that the Shakti is awakened by word, touch, look, or thought. As a matter of creed, this is the role that Bhagawan Nityananda played for Muktananda. That's his guru. So guru on guru on guru here.
Okay.
And it is the role that Muktananda would play for thousands across the globe. So to say that in simpler words,
okay,
Muktananda is the guru of the Siddha Yoga path.
Okay.
Her parents are his followers.
Right.
His guru didn't have a guru of his own. According to legend, he just kind of found enlightenment.
This is Bhagwan?
Yes.
Do you know if it's the same as the guru in the Wild, Wild Country documentary on Netflix?
I don't know.
He is like a crazy
I'll have to look.
Person.
I know that Gurumai is the guru in Eat, Pray, Love.
Probably not, because that seems a little more normal.
I don't know. We'll have to look.
Okay.
At the age of 14, Muktananda initiates Gurumai into this path through something called the Shaktipat, which is a transference of spiritual energy from one person to another, usually from a guru to a follower of some sort. And she actually moved into the ashram with him, along with a lot of other devotees.
Okay.
At the age of 20, he made her his official English translator.
Oh, wow.
And she accompanied him on his second and third world tours.
Whoa. Okay.
Now, May 3rd, 1982, she's initiated as a sannyasin, which is a step in the order of enlightenment. It's the final step.
Okay.
It means that you take vows of poverty, celibacy, obedience, and you acquire a monastic name as well. And this is when she got the name Swami Chidvilasananda, which is Sanskrit for bless of the play of consciousness. Gurumai is technically a title, which means of the guru. Now, it's also at this time on May 3rd, 1982, that Muktananda formally designates her as his successor.
Oh, what?
Right. So okay. She very quickly ascends. And the way it works is actually that a couple months earlier, Muktananda had named her brother as his successor. Her brother is 18 okay. at the time. And then a couple months later, just out of nowhere, he starts referring to my successors, plural. And no one really knows what he's talking about when he's talking all of a sudden. Where's this S coming from? And then he's like, oh yeah, since there's men and women in the world, it makes sense that there would be a guy and a girl to succeed me. So I'm going to name her as well.
Blessings. Right. Peace and blessings exactly. to that. Okay, great.
So later, Guru Mai says of this experience of being named as a successor, she says, quote, at one point during the ceremony during which Baba Muktananda passed on to me the power of his lineage, he whispered Soham and Aham Brahmasmi in my ear. I experienced the mantra as an immensely powerful force which rocketed at lightning speed throughout my bloodstream and created an upheaval in my entire system. I instantly transcended body consciousness and became aware that all distinctions, such as inner and outer, were false and artificial.
Wow.
Everything was the same. What was within me was also without. My mind became completely blank. There was only this pulsating awareness, quote, I am that, accompanied by great bliss and life. When my mind again began to function, all I could think of, what is Baba? Who is this being who looks so ordinary, yet has the capacity to transmit such an experience at will? Now, a couple months later, Muktananda dies in October 1982, okay. which is when the crazy stuff starts happening.
Oh, boy.
Right.
Okay.
So Guru Mai and her brother become spiritual heads of this Siddha yoga path.
Okay.
Her brother leaves in 1985 and claims in an interview a year later that he leaves of his own volition with the wish that his sister would become the sole guru. But then in 1994, he admits that he had had sexual relationships with several devotees and claims that he was isolated for 18 days, caned for 3 hours, and then banished from the ashram. Now, his sister does confirm the isolation and the caning, but denies that he was ever banished. Now, it's at this point when I would like to turn to the article by Liz Harris called O Guru Guru Guru,
okay.
which appeared in the New Yorker in 1994, which is when he has the second right. interview revelation. Some people say that the seeds of conflict had been there from the beginning. Shortly after Muktananda's funeral, Guru Mai and Nityananda gave speeches about their new roles. Nityananda, his eyes filling with tears and his voice choking with emotion, this is her brother,
right.
clasped his sister's hand, held it up in the air and said, quote, people have already started creating a split between us. She is better and he is bad. He is better and she is bad. I want you to know one thing. Many of you all know that we were born to the same family and we have been united since childhood. No matter what you may do, no matter what you may think of us, we won't split. So 3 years later, after this speech where he's like, we're never right. going to split, they arrive at the ashram for ceremonies commemorating the third anniversary of Muktananda's death. Nityananda had told friends that he thought it might be a good idea for him to take time out and embark on a tour of the holy sites in India. And they think this is because of the tension that had right. started growing between them. But that trip never took place. Instead, Nityananda ended up embarking on an odyssey that would ultimately take him to exile at his own small ashram. Now, when Liz finds him in interviews, she says in the article, he readily admitted to me that as Siddha charged, he had broken his vows, and that between the ages of 19 and 23, before his departure from Siddha, he had had sexual encounters with 6 women. He said he regretted those lapses, and that he was basically cornered by Guru Mai. He tried to leave on the night of the ceremony,
right.
found that the tires to all of his cars had been slashed.
Wow.
And when he went to confront his sister about it, she basically invited him into this room. He was surrounded by a bunch of people, like a bunch of thugs, yeah. essentially. They accused him of all these things. She got these 6 people, the 6 women right. that she accused him of sleeping with and breaking his vows of chastity,
yeah.
gave them a cane, and then over the next 3 hours, vocally encouraged them to beat him.
Wow.
So after all of these revelations come out, we start learning more about Muktananda and Guru Mai's role in helping him during his tenure as the guru. He had actually been sexually assaulting younger members of the of the yoga path. Two things about this. One, it feels a lot like Scientology. Because a lot of it is they make you tell them all your secrets. Whenever people would be like, I want to leave or I need to go to therapy, they would send them to people who were friends of the guru or of the path. And then those therapists would report everything back to the gurus. They would have, whenever people would try to leave, they would have people go out and send like thugs essentially to either get them to come back or to scare them into not saying anything. And then the other thing it feels like is the Harvey Weinstein scandal.
Yeah.
Where Guru Mai would say, hey, we're going to go, you know, be with Muktananda. And then she'd be like, peace out, I'm going. And the people would be left with Muktananda. Now, it's interesting because a lot of the stories you hear, including from some of these girls who had these experiences with him, is that he never finished. He never ejaculated. One of the experiences, apparently there was this special table that was built that was a lot like a gynecological table.
Oh, this is going to be a zero for me.
Where he inserted himself flaccid. And they just sat there for a couple hours. The woman explains it as like an incredibly transcended experience where they laughed and talked and had this moment. He never finished. He pulled out of it and they were done.
This is just bizarre.
No, it's very strange.
Like physically, I want to know how that worked, but that's fine. We don't have to go into that, but anywho.
Exactly.
Whoa. Okay.
So all of that happens in the 1980s with her brother.
Whew.
80s and 90s, Guru Mai goes on to give lectures and conduct Siddha yoga intensives in countries around the world. Participants were getting the actual Shaktipat initiation, which is what she had got when she was actively converting people into the Siddha yoga meditation practice. She writes 9 books on spiritual discourse, 3 books of poetry, 3 books of spiritual stories for children, which have been published in 14 different languages.
What?
And since 2004, she's actually disappeared from the public eye. She's not really seen in public anymore. Near the beginning of every year, she releases a video to her followers, like a spiritual video, to say like, this is what you should be focusing on this year. But that's all anyone has seen of her in the last, 14 years at this point.
Whoa.
Yeah, she's still alive to this day. She is the current head of the Siddha yoga path.
This just makes me even more want to not do yoga. I don't have the patience for yoga.
I find yoga to be very painful.
It's just boring. I would rather go for a run. I can't focus.
I feel that. I also think that this is a different kind of yoga.
It's clearly a different kind of yoga. I don't want a movie about that, but I do want a documentary series. And you should definitely go and watch Wild Wild Country because this makes me think, that Bhagwan, who you mentioned, is the one in the documentary. Also, how many gurus are named Bhagwan? I don't know. Is it common?
I don't know.
He starts a cult in Oregon. You've got to watch this documentary. It's cray.
I think I saw the announcement for it. Netflix had the self-play, autoplay thing at the top.
Yes.
That looks so interesting.
Check it out.
I'll have to look into it.
Okay. Well, on a totally different note, Agnetus, get ready. First off, it's debated whether or not Agnetus was a real person or more of a legend or fable. But there's some debate, so we didn't do her in the mythology episode. And her story is way too freaking cool, so we got to get into it.
Okay,
so she likely lived in ancient Athens around the 4th century BCE. And during this time, women were forbidden from studying medicine, and it was a crime punishable by death.
Oh.
So, super forbidden. Not like, hey, don't do that. We're going to stone you. So she was raised in a wealthy family. And as she was growing up, she was appalled by the high infant mortality rate and the rate of which mothers died in childbirth. Now, this was due partly because men were the only ones allowed to study medicine and women would not go to see a male doctor to deliver their children.
Fair.
I mean, they all just need to go and live in the mascara. That's all I'm saying. So, but this is what inspires her to study medicine. So she really wants to become a doctor. So she disguises herself as a man by cutting her hair really short. And she began studying medicine under Herophilus in Alexandria.
Oh.
So after studying and becoming a physician, she began taking a lot of female patients. And a lot of women were ashamed of having a male doctor, especially while they were in labor, clearly. And so they wouldn't go to the doctor at all. But Agnetus would reveal her true gender to a lot of women in Athens, and then they allowed her to treat them.
Oh, really putting herself in danger.
Right. So apparently in Hippocratic treatises from the time, men had written about how women would not see them for treatment or for births, and they could not figure out why, except their theory was that women were stubborn and didn't want to take care of themselves. They never suspected it could be from the fact that their only choices in doctors were men.
Right. Maybe look in the mirror.
Hello. So the way the story goes then is that when Agnetus returned to Athens from Alexandria, she heard the screams of a woman in labor and rushed to help. And the woman, thinking that Agnetus was a man, tried to force her out, but then she hey, I'm a lady.
Flashed her or something.
Yeah. So she grows this large client base and following among basically all the women. And then she was accused of seducing her patients and forced to go to trial. So she went to trial. And in order to prove again that she was a woman, yes, she does flash them. She lifts her tunic.
Mm-hmm.
And they were then going to charge her with breaking the law that forbade women from practicing medicine. But then all the prominent women in Athens came to her defense and said they would not stand to see her go to jail since she was the only physician they trusted. The wife said, quote, "You men are not spouses, but enemies, since you are condemning her who discovered health for us."
Oh, my word.
Which is pretty baller.
Absolutely.
So instead of indicting Agnetus, they changed the law so that freeborn women could study medicine.
Oh.
Wow. Why didn't we think of that in the first place? I don't know. Hello.
Oh, women can be doctors.
Oh, could have had a V8. So Agnetus is considered the first female physician or the first female gynecologist, and she's become a symbol of female equality, determination, and ingenuity. And we know most of her story because it was written by a Roman author, Gaius Julius Hyginus, in Fabulae.
Okay.
He referred to her as an obstetrix. Now, other historians say that midwives did exist during this time, but Agnetus was set apart because she had actual medical training rather than just like, choose some herbs, darling. That will help.
Bite down on this.
Yeah. So most people agree that Agnetus was probably not a historical figure, but her training under Herophilus, who's credited for discovering the ovaries, would have placed her around the 4th century. So it kind of works. They also argue, historians, over why women weren't allowed to practice medicine before Agnetus. And historian Kate Hurd Mead believes it was because that they were actually being accused of performing abortions, which is also probably true. Her story, Agnes' story, has been used by women since to argue for their place in the medical world. A midwife in the 17th century referred to herself as a modern Agnetus. That was Elizabeth Sillier. And whether or not her story is true, it does reveal one problem that is still a problem today. Male doctors not understanding female patients. Because clearly Agnetus would have a better understanding of female anatomy and any pain or discomfort that the women were feeling, as she was a woman herself. Jeanette says, "I'm sure once all the other women figured out they could see a female doctor, they jumped at the chance. If ladies have horror stories from seeing male doctors now, imagine what that shit was like in 4th century BCE. Now, prior to Agnetus, there were actually a lot of women who worked in medicine or who were midwives. But by the 5th century BCE, men had become very suspicious of women's reproductive anatomy and wanted to be able to have some semblance of control over it. So men started taking over gynecology because a woman's potential to sabotage her husband's lineage was a great source of anxiety for men.
Ugh.
Grow up.
Ugh.
So the advent of Hippocratic medicine was basically the same time when women were barred from practicing medicine.
One step forward, one step back.
Right. Now, while Agnetus' story has been interpreted time and again as women can practice medicine too, there's another interpretation that is starting to kind of float around. Organizations and other people are using Agnetus as proof or as an example that gender fluidity has existed for some time.
Oh.
There's a Swiss group called the Agnetus Foundation that works for the integration of people who are transsexual, intersex, or transgender. And the founder says of Agnetus, quote, We can assume that if Agnetus was successful in practicing OBGYN, being a gynecologist as a man, she must have been at least very androgynous and gender variant, which I guess is a solid point.
Yeah, gender fluidity has been around for literally ever.
Exactly. So that's Agnetus.
That's
pretty
amazing.
Dope.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot.
I never even heard of her.
Basically said, I'm going to be a doctor and I don't care what you have to say about that.
Bye. I mean, I think my favorite though is like, women are not allowed to be doctors. We're going to kill you. Oh, wait, we could just allow women to be doctors. Like, that will be better. Duh.
Oh, yeah, that rule actually isn't so hard and fast. Man, let's just change it.
Oh. Hey, friends, if you are having a great time listening to this podcast, hooray, we're super glad you like it. Now look down at your phone or your iPad or your computer, whatever you are listening on, and leave us a rating or a review, because those ratings and reviews help other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. Thanks.
If you are enjoying this podcast and you've already left us a rating or a review, or even if you haven't, you should check us out on Patreon. Now, there's two ways to do this. You either go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor, or you download the Patreon app and you look for Ursula Major there. On Patreon, not only do we put clips and deleted scenes, we put bloopers. So find us on Patreon. Thanks.
I stumbled across something crazy today that I wanted to share because it fits in so well with the story of Agnetus. Do you know what the oldest continually operating university in the world is?
I don't.
Okay. Did you know it was founded by a woman?
I did not.
So I don't know that much about this because I just saw a thing.
Okay.
Do you know anything?
I don't.
Okay. Well, then let's look it up.
Okay.
This is crazy. Okay. It's in Morocco.
Uh-huh.
It is, and bear with me because I literally just found this like 5 minutes ago, but it's the University of Al-Khawarian.
Okay.
Also written a bunch of other ways. The university is located in Fez, Morocco.
Uh-huh.
It is the oldest existing, continually operating, and the first degree-awarding educational institution in the world, according to both UNESCO and Guinness World Records, and it is sometimes referred to as the oldest university. But it was founded by Fatima Al-Firi in 859, and it subsequently became one of the leading spiritual and educational centers of the historic Muslim world. It was then incorporated into Morocco's modern state university system in 1963. She was the daughter of a wealthy merchant named Mohammed Al-Firi. They had migrated from Karian, hence the name of the mosque, in Tunisia to Fez in the early 9th century. Fatima and her sister Miriam were both well-educated, and they inherited a large amount of money from their father, and she vowed to spend her inheritance on the construction of a mosque suitable for her community.
That's amazing.
This is so cool.
Apparently, the mosque at the middle has enough room for 22,000 worshippers and to this day remains the largest in Africa.
Whoa, that's so cool.
At first, the madrasa, which means school,
mm-hmm.
focused on religious instruction and Quran memorization, but later expanded into Arabic grammar, music, Sufism, medicine, and astronomy. But it wasn't until 1947 that the school was integrated into the state education system. Physics, chemistry, and foreign languages are introduced in 1957. 1963, it joins the modern state university system. In 1965, it's officially renamed University of Al-Khawarian.
This is so cool. This, again, is just like, why do we not know this?
I don't know. I really want to go here now.
I want to go here, and we should definitely do a segment on her.
Absolutely.
But I mean, because you and I have both searched, like, who are famous women from history?
Oh my God,
and we've
so
also, like, specifically searched, like, who are famous people from around the world? Or, like, I've typed in, like, famous women in history in Asia or in South America.
You find,
like
everything that you can.
Yeah.
Every modifier you can.
And we've never come across this.
Well, you know, what was funny is that when we first Googled this,
mm-hmm.
You typed in, I think, oldest university in...
Yeah, and the University of Bologna in
up.
Italy came up, which is the oldest in Europe, which is fair.
Which is fair, but in the description it said, the University of Bologna is the oldest university in Europe. The oldest one in the world is...
In Morocco.
And it's like, why do you need to... Why do
and
you
I said,
skip?
Because white people. That's what I said. And I'm white, so I can say
I
it.
Mean, so
wah,
am I.
Wah,
wah. Wah, wah.
I mean, and speaking of medicine, like, mm-hmm. just, again, from randomly knowing things about medical history, like, pretty much all modern medicine mm-hmm. comes from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And then through to Spain, and then through to England. So, this is, like, the start of everything.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the...
Math.
A lot of the ancient world, I mean, a lot of the foundations of math and science and belief that we have mm-hmm. right now come out of... The Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Super cool.
Yeah. Oh, and Africa. Part and parcel.
In keeping with the times and with the Agnetus yes. theme of the week, uh-huh. we are going to once again give a shout out for our cause of the week to Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood.
Planned
Parenthood.
You can find them at PlannedParenthood.org. What does Planned Parenthood do? Everything.
Everything. First of all, go back to last season and listen to the episode about Margaret Sanger.
I think that was our first season.
Was it? Oh,
I
my word.
I think it was one of the first ones. Yeah.
Either way, go and listen to Margaret Sanger and then support your local Planned Parenthood.
Yep. PlannedParenthood.org. You can find them. You can go there for cancer screenings. Women can go there for just their yearly pap smears and checkups and, you know.
Whatever other
medical needs that you might have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I feel like I want to make a sped commercial that's like Planned Parenthood. It's not just for abortions. Is that terrible or is that
no,
a great idea?
It's not just for abortions.
I know. I know.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like a spoof commercial.
I do. Like an SNL, like a mid commercial when they're doing
their
quick changes.
I think I
got to
text this to Roni.
Yes. Roni.
Because she wants to do season 2 of Control-Alt-Delete. Like, talk about a great video to share during a campaign.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Right. Anyway, that's PlannedParenthood.org. Thank you so much for joining us this week. As always, we could not do the show without our amazing, amazing team. So thank you to Kim,
Jess,
Sydney,
and Jeanette.
Woohoo!
If you'd like to find us, you can find us on Instagram. Just search The Bitchery of History.
Facebook, just search The Bitchery of History.
And on Twitter, we are Bitchery Podcast. Switching it up.
Perfect. And yes. then, of course, you can find us on our website, umpboh.com. That's Ursula Major Productions, Bitchery of History. You can buy some stickers there.
Buy some stickers. You can also contact us through our listener submission page.
And remember,
bitches get stuff done.